today we're very lucky to have someone at the core of this set of developments address some of the fundamental issues in Denmark. The basics of the bio of Minister Frederiksen have been made available to you, but let me simply say that he has been Minister of Employment since 2001, prior to which he was Secretary General of the Liberal Party from 1985 to that time, 2001. In 1983, he was Administrative Manager of the National Organization of the Danish Liberal Party, Secretary in the Employer Association for Industrial Trades, before that, Head of Section in the Ministry of Agriculture, and Secretary in the Secretariat for the Parliamentary Group of the Liberal Party before that. He obviously brings an outstanding set of credentials to his position. We feel, Mr. Minister, very privileged to have your visit here, and we're looking forward to hearing from you about this very interesting phenomenon in Denmark. Let me also say that you should note that we are recording today's session. We intend to make the audio session of both the minister's comments and discussion available on our website, www.csis.org. So when we get to the discussion phase of our exchange, I will ask you to use the microphones in front of you. So with that, let me offer again, Mr. Minister, a warm welcome to CSIS. Thank you so much for agreeing to join us here today.
Thank you very much to the CSIS for giving me this opportunity to discuss the future of the welfare state and globalization. I'm very honored to to meet such an assembly of distinguished experts, and I wish to thank the Council of Competitiveness for hosting this meeting. In many ways, the Danish policy combines the focus of the CSIS on globalization with the competition parameters that are of interest to the Council of Competitiveness. So I think I'm in the right hands here. I'm also very happy to have the company of members of the American Danish Business Council and from congressional friends of Denmark. It is, of course, comfortable to have friends such a long way from home. We will have the opportunity of exchanging views, but before getting to that, allow me one rhetorical question. What are we doing in Denmark to prepare the welfare state for the future? And the short answer is, we are reshaping it through reform. In Denmark, we cannot, and you perhaps can in the United States, leave it to the market forces to reform your economy. We understand that the longevity of a welfare state with its higher degree of government involvement depends on reform. Also, when this means tough political decisions such as a higher retirement age. It's important to stress that our reforms are not defensive reforms. They do not merely aim at securing certain benefits. They are offensive. We believe that through times we can make our welfare state a positive competition parameter in tomorrow's globalized economy. A few months ago, a historic reform was adopted in the Danish Parliament. It will result in tens of thousands of extra hands on the future labor market. It will also mean that we can afford huge investments in education, training, and research. With this reform, Denmark can maintain its competitive power without jeopardizing social cohesion for a long period ahead. But before coming to the Danish welfare reform, a few words about the future challenges. You are experts when it comes to global challenges. You will probably agree that politicians in the Western world have to take two factors into account in the planning of our strategy for the future. The first is the demographic development, with higher life expectancies and low birth rates. The second factor is the globalization. The demographic development is an economic threat because it reduces the labor force and increases the number of persons dependent on public support. Globalization is, on the contrary, a unique economic chance. It is a fact that the globalization results in a loss of unskilled jobs in the developed countries. But it may also lead to new and better jobs. The outcome may be cheaper goods and a growth in exports. But it's a precondition that we are one step ahead in the competition on qualifications, innovation, and flexibility. The U.S. is very well equipped to the global race. You have a small public sector, low taxes, and a highly market-based labor market. This gives you a head start in the competition on innovation and flexibility. On top of that, your system is not seriously threatened by the demographic development. In the Aging Vulnerability Index from 2003, the U.S. holds the third place. But the biggest U.S. advantage is that your labor market pretty much automatically transforms itself. When competition conditions change, the economy more or less automatically finds a new equilibrium. This is why I think that you will still be in the first division and reap the benefits of globalization in 10, 20, or 30 years' time. But now to Denmark. We also understand that it is important to be one step ahead. Our ambition is to stay in the first division. But at the same time, we wish to avoid the workers who are not well equipped for the challenges of globalization are left behind. Our goal is to maintain competitiveness without jeopardizing social cohesion. Experiences from bigger European welfare states seems to suggest that these two ambitions are irreconcilable. In Germany and France, workers are protected by strong central agreements and generous social benefits. But the price for the high levels of social security is a low degree of flexibility, economic stagnation, and high rates of unemployment. I'm happy to say that the situation in Denmark is different. We have succeeded in combining flexibility with social security. This has led to a new term we call flexicurity. This seems to be very simple, but it takes a lot more than just combining two words. Flexicurity is a very delicate balance between liberal rules on hiring and firing, generous social benefits, and an active employment policy. If a Danish worker becomes unemployed as a result of globalization, he will receive unemployment benefits which are nearly as high as his wage. We also help him to find a new job, and we demand that he is himself active in search for a new job. If he fails to find a job within the same occupational field, the public system will finance his retraining for a new occupation. This means that the workers are not scared of adapting to new conditions, and that it is easier for employers to recruit labor with the right skills and qualifications. Flexicurity is a decisive factor when it comes to explaining why Denmark tops many international studies when it comes to competitiveness and business climate. This is evident in many ways. Many foreign and in particular American companies are making investments in Denmark. Growing exports have generated thousands of jobs. In spite of outsourcing, the unemployment rate in Denmark is the lowest for three decades and at the same level as the United States. Statistics shows that Danes are the most happy people in the world. In spite of the fact that we pay more than 50% of our salaries in taxes. It may be hard to understand why we have picked this moment to trouble the happy Danish population with reforms. But when it comes to future challenges, politicians in welfare states are facing other concerns than our American colleagues. First, the Danish system is much more vulnerable to the demographic development than the US society. The working population in Denmark will soon shrink, and coming generations will be stuck with increasing welfare costs. Secondly, reforms of the welfare state do not occur more or less automatically as they do on the American labor market, again due to our system based on higher degree of government involvement. A private company adjusts to market fluctuations and changes in competition. This is not the case with laws and regulations, national budgets and public institutions. That is why the Danish government has understood that the welfare state comes with a price, namely the price of reform. In many ways, the commitment to reform is a curse. You are bound to come up with something unpopular when you change what people consider to be well-earned rights. But nevertheless, in 2003, the Danish government embarked upon the most radical reform in recent times. Let me give you a few details about our reform. The precondition for a successful reform is a well-prepared strategy, and of course that this strategy comes well out of the starting block. The reform strategy of the Danish government is to prepare the soil for reforms in due time. We are doing this by encouraging an open-minded and broad debate. Reform policies may quickly turn into a kamikaze action, and certainly covert hasty reforms risk never leaving the ground. You only have to remember the attempt by the French government to reform the employment and layoff rules during the summer holidays. But of course the reform caught the public eye, and there was nothing wrong about the reform, except that it was planted in hostile soil. In Denmark, the government did not come up with any ready-made proposal for reform. We set up by appointing an independent welfare commission. This commission was tasked with identifying future challenges, making recommendations, and creating a general debate over the issues. When the commission presented its recommendations, there was already a broad political consensus about a reform of the welfare state. The majority of the population was still against this idea, but the government no longer had to carry the burden alone. I think this paved the way for the reform. The soil had, so to speak, been fertilized. In the months of June, we could sign the historic reform agreement. It had very wide support in the Danish parliament. It had the support of 158 out of the 179 members in the Danish parliament. This is important in itself, and the broad support makes it a solid reform that will last far into the future that it anticipates. The strategy of maturing the actions was successful in three ways. Firstly, it made it possible to actually reach a long-term agreement on major changes. Secondly, it showed that reform policy is not necessarily a kamikaze action. Actually, the population's confidence in the government increased during this process. And thirdly, the open-minded debate has done away with the concerns in the population regarding globalization. 70% of the population believe that globalization will benefit Danish companies and our economy. In the European Union as a whole, only 40% believe so. it is not a coincidence that it was the Danish Prime Minister who, during his recent visit at Berkeley, suggested to set up a transatlantic marketplace which can take globalization an important step further. Now, on the details of our welfare reform and how it prepares the welfare state for the future. Primarily, it does this in three ways. By increasing the labor force, by raising the level of training and education, and by focusing on research and innovation. The growth in the labor force is by far the most important factor. The reform means that employment in the year 2025 will be 4% higher than it would be than it otherwise would have been, and this takes the sting out of the demographic threat. The biggest effects are obtained from two measures which will lead to a postponement of labor market withdrawal. The first is to increase the retirement age from 65 to 67 years up to the year 2027. The second measure is the changes in our very popular voluntary early retirement scheme. Today it is possible to take early retirement from the age of 60 years, but from 2022 the age limit will be 62 years. These two measures are politically very sensitive issues in the Danish reform. A higher retirement age will affect all persons and is one of the most unpopular things that politicians can do. It's an important detail in the reform that in the future the retirement age will be further increased in line with the higher life expectancies. In doing so, we make it easier for future decision makers to shoulder their responsibility. The higher rate of employment will make a big difference in the future. It means that we can afford increased investments in training, education, and research. A higher level of education and training is actually the second item on the list when it comes to how the reform will prepare Denmark for the future. We will ensure that 95% of young persons in year 2015 will go into training or education after finishing their basic schooling. Furthermore, 50% of each youth generation should continue a higher education by the year 2015. Education and vocational training are top priorities. There will be fewer unskilled jobs in the future. This means that we must compete on qualifications and not on wages. The concentration of efforts on research and innovation is the third element of the reform. We must be one step ahead when it comes to technologies and creativity. As from 2010, the state will invest 1% of the GDP in research programs. The high employment rate, education and vocational training activities, and our head start in research and innovation will ensure the survival of the welfare state. With the welfare reform, Denmark will maintain its strong competitive power without ruining the social cohesion. This reform testifies that the welfare society actually has a competitive and sustainable future. Finally, a few words about the government's efforts to reshape the public sector. The welfare reform is certainly the most important one, but it is not the only reform in Denmark. We have also done a major structural reform. It will reduce the number of counties and municipalities and will lead to a more rational distribution of tasks in the public sector. We have recently introduced what we call a quality reform. The aim of this reform is to ensure that public institutions will offer the high quality services that will be required in the future. Both reforms reflect the perseverance of the government in the pursuit of its goal to make the public sector function super efficient. Because only through a streamlined public sector can Denmark keep its leading position as regards to qualifications, innovation, and flexibility. This line of reasoning may sound surprising coming from a liberal minister, but I have to recognize that Denmark will never be the minimal state described by John Locke, and Denmark should never be that, and that for several reasons. The first is that the public sector in a country like Denmark can very well be both efficient and innovative. It can make far-sighted investments in research, education, and innovation. Flexicurity is the instrument which will ensure a flexible labor force. Secondly, we have a long tradition for the public sector taking care of citizens, especially the most vulnerable groups. This is not in conflict with the principal liberal axiom, the ideal of freedom. High level of training and education will give all persons the freedom to fully exploit their abilities and potentials. Affordable childcare facilities will give both men and women the freedom to work. High public allowances will give people the freedom to adapt to new conditions and possibilities of retraining for new jobs in case of relocation of their jobs to India. But the liberal ideal is not just compatible with a huge public sector. The public sector also needs the liberal principles in order to function in an efficient manner. This is why the current government has put many liberal fingerprints on the public sector. We have privatized the public sector and opened up for private alternatives to public services. We have breathed new liberal life into many institutions. They've become independent and self-governing institutions and been given incentives to compete. And not least, we have brought the upward-going tax spiral we have lived with for several decades to an end and have reduced taxes. This came as a miracle for the Danish population. All these liberal initiatives reflect the same intention as the important welfare reform: a sincere will to reshape the welfare state and prepare it for the future. I will conclude this presentation by saying that the Danish reform will is very interesting example for other European countries. It shows that there is a viable European alternative to the American highly market-driven system. In a recent report, the OECD has pointed to Denmark and the other Scandinavian countries as such an alternative. The European Union is working on a development of common principles for flexicurity. And in this context, Denmark plays a crucial role as a sort of source of inspiration for the other member states. But what can Americans learn from the Danish experience? I guess not very much. You have a quite different political tradition than we have. It has already given its liberal answer to the question how you are able to keep your enormous country in top form. I think it'll take quite a while before the ordinary American citizens will put up with paying more than half of his wages in tax, and therefore it will be interesting for me to hear your comments, and thank you very much for your attention and for giving me the opportunity to present what we are doing in Denmark. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Minister, thank you very much for those insightful and very candid comments. I'd like to begin by offering the chance to our co-chairs to make comments or ask questions. So, Robin, would you like to begin by making a statement or by asking a question of the minister?
I don't have a statement, but certainly in terms of making a just a quick comment and then maybe a question or two.
It's interesting, we've had a couple of meetings here at CSIS Europe Programme, in fact, meetings not only on the economic side but also on defence. And the Danish model seems to keep cropping up on a number of occasions, including not just on the economic front, as I said, but also on the security front, where they've done some very interesting reforms in their security posture and how they're using their investments as well in that area. And that, I suppose, brings me to the question which perhaps comes up quite often, which is whether, Mr. Minister, you could distinguish between what's unique about Denmark and what, you know, how transferable, therefore, some of the models that you've developed within Denmark might be in other parts of the European Union. You noted yourself the difficulties that France and Germany have had in their particular labour markets, but is that a matter are there structural problems there, or is it simply a matter of political will? I was struck especially by your comment of how large the parliamentary consensus was on this reform. I'm trying to visualize that type of consensus in France, perhaps in Germany. Maybe there is some consensus evolving there. And therefore, any comments you might make about whether you feel that the success you've demonstrated with your model is starting to raise questions amongst other governments. I would note that certainly in my opinion, the potential for European Union countries to reform going forward and to be competitive in the global economy depend on precisely the type of national reforms that your country has instituted. The idea that the European Union can offer a vehicle through integration across borders to meet the competitiveness, I think, is not correct right now. It did a lot for the European Union in the 70s and 80s, but really we're in a phase now where national reform is paramount, and therefore I think some of the examples that you've given through your country's example are extremely valuable, hopefully will be taken up by others. If I could throw one last question in rather than a statement, what is immigration like in Denmark? Because the kind of balance you seem to be describing here and this moving up the value chain, is that predicated upon you allowing immigrants in to take in some of the less popular types of jobs that maybe aren't at the higher end of the value chain? I just wonder where immigration stands in the whole picture.
Before you answer, since Robin nicely took my question, I did want to say that that your talk has made me happy already, a little happier. I think that this might be a recruitment campaign that perhaps you're attracting people to Denmark. But just to follow up on Robin's question, just in terms of the sustainability, the percentage of the population receiving these generous benefits and the special problem of immigration and how this reformed system will be able to address that issue.
All right, let's leave it there for the Minister. I show what is unique about Denmark, what is transferable elsewhere, possibility of consensus, immigration, and sustainability. Mr. Minister, over to you.
I do not believe that you can transform a system from one country to another country, because our system has its historic roots. It's grown out by the social partners' involvement during the last 100 years. One of the preconditions in our society is the high degree of organizing in the trade unions and on the employer side. In trade unions, I think 80% of the Danes are organized in a union, and the employers are likewise organized, which means that we have very little legislation on labor market conditions in Denmark, because it has been throughout the years accepted that if the parties themselves would agree, then this would be the state of the facts on the Danish labor market. Then there would be a residual for those people who were not covered, who had not been given 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks vacation. Then we had to legislate for the groups that didn't have the same rights through an agreement. So I think one of the preconditions of this is an acceptance that it is agreement. It's agreement-based system that we have. Then we have been so fortunate that the parties on the labor market has taken a wildly economic responsibility in their actions. When the economy demanded that wage rises were low, they agreed on low wage rises. In the 80s, they agreed to build up pension funds for each worker on the Danish labor market, and each one has now an account where the employer pays. It's different from agreement to agreement, I guess 9, 10, 11, 12 points percent paid by the employer. And that is took, of course, slowed down the wage increases and made a sustainable pension system that in 20 years' time, most Danes will have a labor market pension to live up of when they get pensioners. And that is one of the things that the parties have been able to foresee. We have now had a tripart negotiations, because we have wage agreements next year in February, March, and there has been, as an outspring of this globalization discussion, there's been the desire by the trade unions to build up personal accounts for each worker to use as lifelong learning thing. So you can save up on your account, and if you are globalized out of your business because suddenly the textile industry doesn't pay in Denmark anymore or shipyards disappear, you can change a line of your personal work. And we hope that this will carry, that this will spread so that we can gradually over the next 20, 25, 30 years build up these accounts. So I'm saying this, that a precondition for what we are doing is the high percentage in organization combined with a mutual responsibility for both parties. Then I think we shall back to the 70s or 60s, where you can imagine that struggles on the labor market had some sort of more violent class struggle, communist type thing. It's been very, very smooth and developed into a very practical arrangement. So I don't think that you can transform the system to another country, but of course we can learn from each other. And each, when you look at the European countries, each country has a form of flexicurity, but with different aims and different means. So we cannot say that we're the only one who has invented this. Our system is based upon, and this is we've had many French delegations visiting us throughout the past year because they'd like to learn something about flexicurity. But it always ends up with that they are mostly interested in how you can hire and fire people easily. That is the main concern. They forget the other side of the coin in our case is that we pay so high unemployment allowances that you can almost maintain your standard of living as before you lost your job. And of course, this is a very crucial thing that you understand and accept, that you have a high coverage when you are unemployed or when you are sick, but on the other hand, you have the obligation, the duty, to take a job when you can get a job. And If you don't, it is sanctioned in different ways, and if you don't, you could be sent out to a job and would lose your allowances if you don't take the job. This is the second thing. The third thing is that we have what we call an active labor market policy. I mentioned it in my speech that the people who have lost qualifications or where his or her trade has moved forward and need to learn the latest, they get education so they can fulfill the qualifications for the new type of jobs that arise. Then I have to say, we have a very high minimum wage, and now I'm coming to the question of the immigration. We do not have a fixed, we don't have legislation on salaries whatsoever, so we don't have a legal fixed minimum wage. But in each agreement, there are minimum wages. I would guess that the minimum wage in Denmark, we discussed it yesterday, I think it's about $14 or $15 an hour is the minimum wage. And this, of course, puts us in a very difficult position because the immigrants that are coming have difficulties finding jobs because they do not have the chance, as you have here in the United States, of starting at a low salary and then work your way up, because these kinds of jobs do not exist. We're so heavily taxed, and the minimum wage is very high. So doing your garden, cleaning your house, washing your car, filling gas on the car is something you do yourself, because you cannot afford to have people do that. And that is very critical for us when it comes to immigrants, because when you have third world immigrants coming to a modern technological society with modern workplaces, no hard work, so to speak, you don't break stones or anything, it's computerized, many productions, what do these people do? And the fact is that we have among the immigrants 50% unemployment rate. Then we have had for years a troublesome approach when immigrants were coming to Denmark. We had the philosophy that you should learn them Danish, they should learn something about the Danish society. They were put on a school bench. As Danish is difficult to learn, it took a long time. As a minister of employment, I know there is one harsh rule on the labor market, and it goes, the longer you're out of a job, the more difficult it is to get back to a job. And that is written in neon over all our problems. Of course, that is very problematic to immigrants when you put them on a school bench and let them sit there for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, because when are they ready? And we have changed that so that we now have the priority that they go out to get a job very, very early in the process. So we have reduced the social benefits for that group. It will always pay for them to take a job. And we've had some success with it, but we have decades of mistakes in this field to point back to. So immigration has not functioned very well in our country, because we have been stressing too much that we should prepare people in a proper way. If I may quote one of my close friends is a psychiatrist, south of Copenhagen, and he gets many immigrants in his practice, and they have experienced very bad things in the villages where they come from. Children killed, villages bombed, miserable economic conditions. But he says he thinks that the people who stayed behind had to make a living because they had to provide for their children. They had to forget what was going on and get on with their lives and trying to earn some money. Whereas the people coming to a welfare state like Denmark is put in a two-room apartment somewhere, have no contact with the job. Once a month they visit the psychiatrist who reminds them of the awful situation they come from, and they relive every month and every week what they left. And therefore it is very important for us to get these people out in jobs so they can start to think about something else than their tragedy. I'm not saying this is the explanation, but it is a part of the explanation that when you have an extensive welfare state where you have people taking care of people, sometimes it gets too much. And I think that immigrants, to some extent, have suffered for this, making them clients in a social system.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Minister.
Could I just ask one more question, since Robin got to ask?
All right. One short one, please, and then we'll open up.
I just wanted to say that I think what's fascinating for us at the Council is that you begin with the concept of social cohesion and the well-being of the workforce and find a way to satisfy the dictates of the global economy. We begin in the United States with the concept of competitive companies and low prices, and we hope that we'll find a way to bring along the social cohesion in the workforce. And so it's a really different model and really impressive. One of the things that we found is that all of our jobs are at risk, that it's great, and we too focus on innovation, on skills qualification, on training, but when you look at the outsourcing of low-skilled jobs as well as high-skilled jobs, that maybe there's something extra there. Maybe there's that it's the demand pull from the industrial side that you're matching the talent pool and the innovation with that gives you a specialization niche. So I was quickly going to ask about the industrial side of this strategy. Are you pairing the extra training, the investment in research with an industrial strategy that will maximize or optimize for your innovation platform?
I think we have to distinguish on the reasons why companies move out. We have had some surveys made that shows that if a company relocates some of its production to China or wherever it is, but it is done in a proper manner, and is not driven by the mere fact that otherwise they go bankrupt if they don't move out. We can see figures that shows that those companies who do it in a proper way are the companies that are able to create more manpower back home and get more employed back home. We have several good examples of it that they when they make water pumps. Of course, they moved to one big company in Denmark who makes pumps of all kinds. And of course, they move to China because the new market is China. There's no reason why they should sit and produce pumps in Denmark and sending it all around the world when they might as well produce these pumps in China where the market is. But these companies have maintained more workplaces at home, and that is why we are not that afraid of the companies moving out. But we can see if panic breaks out in a company, and they have red figures years in a row, and they say our only chance is to move to China,
they do very badly when they come to China, and you have very few success stories on that. But this is how we have to follow up on it. We have made the decision politically. We will not compete with China on salaries, because our welfare state, that is a contradiction. We have a welfare state with high salaries, high taxes, high public services, and if we say, well, let's go for the Chinese salary, then it wouldn't exist anymore. So that is why we have to find ways to get better jobs. And may I say something that may surprise many of you? I think we have a workforce in Denmark of 2.5 million people. Of those 2.5 million people, 800,000 change jobs every year. That is one-third of the workforce takes on a new job every year. We have 250,000 jobs disappear every year, just disappears, but we are able to create new jobs at the same amount, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less, but the past years a little more than 250,000 a year. So this means there is a massive movement underneath the figures that we have that shows that in a way, people are very prepared to run the risk and take a new job. When we see an Opel factory plant closing down in Germany, I'm sorry to mention Germany all the time, but people to go to the street to demonstrate against the closure. We had recently the Lego, you may know the Lego factories that make these toys for kids. They announced a year ago and they moved all production to China and Czechia. And they were in a small community and no one demonstrated because there was this confidence that, well, then we'll find some other job. And I've been reflecting very much over this, how come that we are not that worried in these situations. And I've come to the conclusion that one of the reasons is that we're a small country. It's known for everyone in Denmark that if we don't earn money, we don't have jobs. Bigger countries have had big state-subsidized industries where the connection between earnings and expenditure somehow is a little unclear to the individual worker. But in a small country, sometimes we had to sell to England after the war, selling agricultural goods, and then came the amazing development, the economic development in Germany, and we've had Sweden and the other Scandinavian countries to sell our goods to. So there is this transparency, I think, helps us a little, and is an awareness on all stages in a company, from the factory floor to the CEO.
Thank you. Let's begin with, may I ask you again, please, to identify yourself and your organization, and let's try to keep our questions as brief as possible. Please.
My name is Martin Ample from the Council of Scientific Society Presidents. I want to focus on a single issue, and that is where do the jobs come from? Do you have a high level of entrepreneurship? How much of that is generated that way? How many of these 800,000, the plus 32,000 and so forth, where do these jobs coming from?
They are all traditional ways that companies expand and need more production and sells more. But we have entrepreneurs that are starting up companies. You have to remember that the structure of the Danish companies is very different to the United States. We do not have huge dominant companies. We have a lot of small companies, and when we talk small companies, it is in American terms small companies. They have their advantages. They are flexible in production. We are very good at deliver at the set time. We can produce in small series. It is very easy to change a series when a customer needs something. So there is, throughout our enterprises, a flexibility that surprisingly makes us survive, whereas big companies, they have scheduled productions and can deliver at certain times. So I think it is the combined with the proper design and things that people find nice to look at and so on. So it's this complexity and with the fact that you can increase and decrease the number of employees as you get orders in the company, they are not afraid to hire people. So I think that is mainly what comes and what people in companies in Sweden, Germany and France are afraid to take people in, because if you take them in, you can't get rid of them again. And that is where our flexible model helps us.
Thank you. I'm Alan Hecht with the EPA. I just want to ask a follow-up on the immigration question. Where is immigration policy set in the Danish government? How is it coordinated with, in terms of these reforms, with employment policy? And is there any sense that the immigration and employment linkages represent security risks or social risks to society?
We have done many things to try to integrate immigrants throughout the years, but we have now come to the conclusion that we need to have what we call a handheld integration. The immigrants do not seek the companies do not seek the immigrants. It's two different worlds. They don't, as Danes, go up to a company and ask to be signed in for a job if there should be one available in some times. They don't write applications and so on. So we have to take, and we will now put a lot of resources in that. That comes from the welfare agreement that we will have to take the handheld effort, maybe the first days, follow people to the workplace, see that they get on the right bus so on. And then you can buy people or mentors off in the company to look after these people in the beginning. And of course it demands more from an employer to engage people, because it is more difficult, and therefore we will give in the beginning a subsidy of 90% of the salary for a period of time to take these people in. And that is what we'll try to do. And now we have then the fortunate situation that there is a shortage of labor, which means that there will be an incentive for employers to take that further step, and I hope it will help us. Then on the other hand, you ask if it poses a threat. I will say that we have never in Denmark seen ghettos or parallel societies because we've been a homogeneous society, but we do see that now. areas in Copenhagen, other bigger cities, where 98% of the people are of foreign origin, where the unemployment rate is 80%, things like that. And it poses a threat to the Danish society insofar that if you do not share the same values of democracy, of equal rights between men and women, and so on, this is a threat, in my opinion. But we're trying to deal with it. I may say that for me personally, I think you all heard about the cartoon crisis that we had in Denmark here in last winter, and for me personally, and for many, many Danes, this came as a shock. First of all, we never thought that a cartoon in a newspaper could be anything, because we're used to see ourselves in that way every day. But then we realized that for some people, the desire of the right to speak, the right of freedom of belief, and so on, was not shared by all in the Danish society, and it was kind of shock. I know you're used to seeing your flags burned everywhere in the world, and but for a little peaceful nation like the Danes, who only do well, this was a shock. So there will be an enforced effort to integrate, and the only conclusion there is that is they should out and get a job, and that is the main thing, because then that is the way to integrate.
Please.
Yeah, to say on that latter point, I think that we are used to having seeing our flags burned. I think there were no small number of people who were thinking at that time, thank heavens it's not us for once, but a small thought. I have a question about retraining of people who've lost their jobs, because it's something that we don't do very well here. And I guess there's two parts. One, who is sort of empirical, who provides the retraining? Does the government do it directly, or does the government simply pay for it, and private sector parties provide retraining? Second, how do you make sure, as best you can, that the retraining that you're providing matches the jobs that you foresee becoming available in the economy? One of the problems we have here is we find ourselves retraining people to undertake jobs that themselves no longer exist. And so there's a constant cycle of people not being retrained for things that the economy needs.
Could you also identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Bill Reinch from the National Foreign Trade
Thanks.
Council.
Appreciate it.
The programs are paid for by the taxpayers. It's on the budget. But the way it's performed is different. It is not performed by the state agency themselves. We use entrepreneurs to take the training courses, and we have throughout the last years refined the system so that we use private companies to perform this, and the payment is that when they get one of the unemployed, they get 20%, and the rest of the payment, 80%, they get if the person is employed 13 weeks after he left the training. So you get an amount of money for having the course, but the 80% of payment falls on week 13 if the person is in a job. And that is a one way that we try to secure that the success rate is not going through a course, but the success is getting a job. And we hope to have gotten rid of previous mistakes where
the, having a cause was the important thing, and we had very absurd situations in parts of Denmark where if you needed a painter and you could see there were five jobless painters in the town, five of them would be on a course, and of course they couldn't take a job as a painter because they were sitting learning something else, and of course that is a wrong way to use your money. So getting a job will give the high payment for the training. And then we can make arrangements with bigger companies if they have a job guarantee in the other end. For example, in Denmark, there's a huge shortage of truck drivers and bus drivers. And if a company can get 100 people, train them, give them their driver's license and so on, and if there is a job guarantee in the other end, then the money is well spent by the state.
Please.
John Ritchie, U.S. Department of State. Just to follow up on that, what about the continued relevance of technical school training, not for the retraining, but for new workers coming up? How is that relationship fluid between the industries and the schools themselves? In many countries, there is often a disconnect, just as the retraining might be, where it's not always in sync with the needs, especially anticipated needs.
We have had some problems with correlation between the demands of young people in apprentices and the desires of the young people, and we have seen that especially for immigrants, being carpenters or things like that has a very low status. They all want to be lawyers or doctors, and if they can't be lawyers and doctors, then nothing counts, so to speak. So even though the life income of a carpenter can compare to almost any other job because they start earning big money earlier than the rest, then we've had some problems in this field. We've also had problems at the university level, that universities graduate people to unemployment because these different courses people take, everyone can say there is no job at the other end because it's so specialized, media jobs or things like that, wanting to be a TV presenter, and the labor market is very small when it comes at that. So we would like to introduce incentives also for the universities that their payment is depending on their students getting a job afterwards. So you cannot just expand faculties where there is no need afterwards. But on the technical schools, there's been a tendency in the past years that there's been a decline in interest, and we're trying to boost it now, but it will be a long process because you've had to start with mathematics and physics in the primary school, and these subjects have been neglected is too strong a word, but they haven't had such a strong presence in the schools, and we have to revive that, and then hopefully we can get more people to take these educations. Otherwise we would have to import Poles and Czechs and Lithuanians for these jobs. But seen on an lifelong income scale, they're very well paid jobs.
I think we have time for one last question. Is there one last? Please.
I'm going to start in the CSIS Europe program. I'm actually working on immigration research, and I wanted to ask you, with the new enlargement of the EU in January 2015,
course, there are young people leaving after graduating from a university. But when you look at the actual figures, it is not a major problem with us. People tend to stay because they can get well-paid jobs in Denmark. But of course, people leave for the United States because their standard of living will increase dramatically when they come over here and get well-paid jobs, as the opposite, having to pay 63% in taxes. So people do not, but I cannot say that it is something that scares us, because it is not to any wide extent happening. What is happening is that we get Polish doctors, Czech doctors, and leaving them with the problem. So the globalization is a funny thing that I read the other day that in some of these Eastern European countries, there's a shortage of skilled labor, there's a shortage of unskilled labor, so they have to take labor in from Ukraine and Belarus, so it moves around. But I cannot say that we are struck by many academics fleeing the country.
Well, Mr. Minister, you've offered a tour de force with respect to a number of issues here. I know that we will be watching this experiment called FlexSecurity with great interest. We would like to thank you so very much for your visit here to CSIS. I'd like to acknowledge with gratitude our co-sponsors, CSIS Europe Program, Council on Competitiveness, and our friends at the American Danish Business Council. Mr. Ambassador, very nice to have you back. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for attending. Would you join me, please, in thanking the Minister for his insightful comments?